You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Welcome to 1001 True Stories. My name is Brian Tremblay, your host. Thank you for joining me. They say everyone has a story, but is it a story that could have ended badly? Do you have an incident in your life when you thought you just weren't going to make it and out of the situation that you were in? Did you have an encounter with someone or something that no one would ever believe had happened to you? That's what happened to my guests. Today's show, my guest is J.L. Hancock. He spent 20 years in the military in the dark corners of the government intelligence communities. Although he wasn't directly involved in this story, he was involved in a very uplifting and heartfelt kind of way. Jim tells us of his friend Chris deployed with SEAL Team 5 on an operation in Afghanistan. Now imagine having to wear a piece of equipment that made you stand out so much that the enemy had orders to kill you first because you were responsible for telling your team where to go. And then things got bad. Hello, folks, and thank you for joining me again on 1001 True Stories. I have a wonderful guest for you today, and he's got a great story for you, I think, that you might find interesting and uplifting, hopefully, in some ways. And I'll turn it over to him to introduce himself.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my name is J.L. Hancock. Friends call me Jim. I am an author and a consultant. I also was in the Navy for 20 years, working as a cryptologist, spent the bulk of that time working for the intelligence communities, as well as Naval Special Warfare as a combat operator embedded with the special operations community, did over 100 combat operations, and ended up becoming the head of innovation for U.S. Naval Special Warfare. Which involves the SEAL teams, and I helped put the first artificially intelligent drone in combat.
Awesome. Well, tell us all about a situation that you were mentioning to me. I think the listeners would love to hear it.
Yeah. So I was thinking of a lot about what would be something that would be both inspiring, insightful, and maybe a bit harrowing regarding this podcast. And because of the date, I just kind of kept leaning towards wanting to just talk about I wasn't directly involved. I was part of this whole thing that happened, but it's mainly about my buddy, Chris. This is March 13th. So on March 12th, 2013, my really good friend, his name was Chris Pike. Christian Michael Pike was his full name. He passed away after combat operations in Afghanistan. And this, I'd like to tell a story a little bit about what happened to Chris and how I was lucky enough to be involved in probably the greatest thing that ever happened in my life that to this day I wish never happened. And that is about, so Chris Pike was a part of the same program that I was embedded in. We were both cryptologists. As cryptologists, our job is to understand the how to exploit and intercept radio waves. So if you think of somebody who does information technology, their job is to make sure the communications work so that your radios are up and your computers are connected to a network so you can pass communication. Electronic warfare is using radio waves to attack over the air interface to jam things and all that kind of stuff. A cryptologist, we live in that middle space. We like to know where signals are coming from. We like to intercept those signals to give and gather what we call indications and warning or precision geolocation. So we want to know where those signals are coming from. We want to know what they mean. We want to know what's inside them. So that's our bread and butter, is living in the world of radio waves.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chris was a part of this program. So cryptologists, to give everybody context, in the Navy, there are about 11,000 total cryptologists out of the entire naval force. Of those individuals, there are only 100 that did the job that we did between the East and West Coast and some other parts of the special operations community. So 100 total operators that were embedded. So at its peak, there were 3,000 Navy SEALs. There were less than 100 of us. And there wasn't really any mission that happened in which one of us was not there. I was in Afghanistan in 2012. And at the same time, my buddy Chris came in with a different unit. He was deploying at the time with SEAL Team 5. I was with the Rangers, deployed with a component with a joint special operations. And Chris was a part of something called the commando units. And the commando units were they were based out of Kandahar, and they were kind of the Afghan special forces groups that were attached to I guess you could put it the other way, that we were attached to them because we were supporting their operations in country at that point in time. It wasn't what we refer to historically as unilateral operations. They were bilateral operations, meaning we were doing it in conjunction with them in an advise and assist role at that point in time, because we were starting to draw back. Chris had been out about 5 months at that point in time. This is in March of 2013. And he'd probably done over 30 combat operations. And he had, every time the platoon went out, he was there with them. Chris, for context, Chris was he was a big dude. We jokingly called him Vin Diesel because he looked like Vin Diesel. Okay. He had the shaved head and the big nose, and he was just a burly dude, and he could deadlift an insane amount of weight. He's really strong.
Cool.
And he was just a really funny guy. Great guy to be around. We all thought that Chris was the future of our program. So Chris went on this op flying out to Maiwan District, and they'd broken up into three different groups as they went into this compound in this small village. And at the time, the difficulty with with that drawdown is we would pull out of certain areas, and then the Taliban would move in. And then we'd have to send the commando units out there to re-engage, to regain control for the Afghan National Army so they could reestablish their presence. And then they would get pushed back again by the Taliban, because what we jokingly referred to as like the Tom and Jerry scenario. I mean, every time, if you have a mouse hole in which the mouse can run through every single time you chase them down, there's not a whole lot you can do. And that mouse hole was Pakistan. And so every time we chase them into the hole, they disappear, regain strength, and just come back. It was really hard to do the things that we wanted to do when the Afghans themselves didn't want to take ownership of the country. It was very difficult. So Chris had this almost impossible task of constantly going back. Well, his unit, as they arrived in this village, they split into two different sections. One went to observation point in the south, and another group went off to an observation point out in the east. And Chris did that. And Chris got on top of the roof of the building and doing what we do. I can't specifically say what type of equipment we used, but we used this equipment that made us stand out. It had a big antenna array that would stick out of the back of us. And in Iraq, certain reporting, they referred to us as the Colonel. And they called us the Colonel because we were the ones always telling them where to go and which house to hit.
Okay.
And the reporting said the first person you should kill is the Colonel.
Oh boy.
Because then they don't know where to go. So we knew there was always a target on our head. We'd go into Afghan villages, and we would see almost like hieroglyphic drawn pictures in rock of individuals that looked exactly like us on the walls of buildings.
Wow.
Not like anybody else. It was very specific type of gear we carried. And now I don't know if this was relative to what happened with my buddy, but he got on the roof like he was supposed to, and he manned his position and was telling everybody where the fire. All of a sudden, they took effective fire coming from a ridge. Chris took his position on the roof of the building. He using his gear, he told everybody where the threat was coming from. They re-engaged. They called in close air support. And then Chris went quiet. It was about at 9:52 a.m. They ended up getting on the roof, what we call the independent duty, the 18 Delta is what you call them, the SEAL teams, but it's actually an army term for the member of the of the special forces team that's the combat medic, basically. They call them, they are the platoon medic. The platoon medic recognized that Chris wasn't moving, grabbed him, pulled him in, and around from it was just this crazy range, came in and hit Chris just below the top of his helmet. So it slipped right under and hit him right in the forehead. And it rode right along the top of his skull, along his brain. The 18 Delta immediately intubated Chris and kept him alive. Within 5 minutes, they had medevac coming to pull them out. They engaged the enemy. They suppressed the threat. They eliminated the threat. They killed over 20 Taliban. And then Chris ended up on a helo headed back to Kandahar. Now, here's the thing that this is where I came into the conversation. Chris was supposed to relieve me as the detachment chief of these operators back here in, we're based out of San Diego. And I was walking into church with my wife and daughter, and my phone rang, and my buddy called me up and he said, hey man, Chris has been hit.
We'll return to our conversation with J.L. Hancock right after these sponsor messages. And now back to 1001 True Stories with Brian Tremblay.
And I was like, well, how bad is it? And he's like, well, it's bad, dude. It's really bad. And I don't remember being hit by anything. It's like the bullet hit me. I cannot remember in my life being struck so profoundly with such an immense amount of just pain. And I was beside myself and I had to leave. I told my wife, I just had to go like right then and there, and went home. And then we ended up going back at the command. Whenever some type of casualty event takes place, you designate somebody as what they call a CACO, a casualty actions calls operator, is what CACO stands for. And we stood up a small tactical operations cell upstairs next to our commanding officer's office that we called the CACO watch. And so we stood a watch of people. There was very little we could do. And this was the most frustrating part about this process. And this was very humbling for a lot of us, is we're used to being in a community where you can just get up and move. You get up and act. If something is going on, you just train yourself to respond. But what do you do when there is nothing for you to do? Like, you literally can't. We couldn't fly to go help. We couldn't physically be near him. We couldn't go and fight anyone. We were on deployment. We were just there. So we stood up the watch, and the watch was just as much to coordinate what's happening with Chris while he was being repatriated as it much was for us to be able to manage what was going on. We had lost other people before, but this was this first time somebody directly in our unit, for those of us on the West Coast, had been injured that way. And Chris was still alive, and he got back to Kandahar, and inside of Chris's ruck, he had a rolled up American flag that he took with him on target every time he went out. He had a Beanie Baby. And I'll tell you the story about the Beanie Baby in a second. Okay. And he had some other things, right? Well, there was an analyst that we had that was working in the same unit as him. And his name was Reese Bell. And Reese Bell took that flag out of Chris's ruck and put it in his pocket. And it stayed there. Reese wasn't, they then put him on an Angel flight. They put Chris and Reese on an Angel flight headed back from Kandahar to Germany, because Chris technically was still alive. This was around December 11th or so, or sorry, March 11th of that year.
Good.
They flew him back, and we were able to coordinate to get Chris's mother and his girlfriend out to Germany to be with him. And they got there just in time to hold his hand one last time. And then the person that we knew, as Chris Pike, left the earth on March 12th, 2013. Reese stayed with Chris. He was repatriated on an Angel flight back to Dover, Maryland, where the chief of naval operations, the head of naval special warfare, all were standing there to greet him as he was repatriated. Mm-hmm. And then he was flown back to Arizona, where he was going to be buried. Now, here's the other. So those of us that were standing that CACO watch, we coordinated the logistics to make sure everything was going right. We made sure everyone was there for the repatriation. And then an Advon team of us went to Phoenix to go be there for when Chris arrived. And in our blues, we stood a watch as Chris arrived. We stood a two-man watch over Chris all the way until the moment that he was through the ceremony, all the way into the end, and to where he was when he was cremated. And then we personally delivered his remains to his mother. And once again, there was only so much we could do. But the reason why I bring this up today is not because of the fact that he's just this amazing person and all the things that happened to them. Is here's the thing that is most poignant about it. And this is where certain individual sacrifices can continue on in impacting lives. When we were driving I was lucky enough to be behind the hearse carrying Chris's casket. And my buddy Jake and I were riding in a car. And as we drove down the road, there was this gentleman pouring gas, pumping gas into his car. And as the Freedom Riders were in front of us, riding on their motorcycles with all the American flags and everything, and everybody recognized that it was a funeral procession. People dropped everything they were doing and ran to the street and saluted. And I, in all the years of service that I'd done up until then, I'd fought in combat a lot of times. And I'm one of those people that when they say, "Hey, I'd like all of our veterans to stand," I'm the person who stays seating because I don't want attention. I just don't care. I'll tell stories about what happened. I like writing books, but me personally, I'm just not some of those people that outwardly and openly is point. People wouldn't know I was in the military if I didn't tell them, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just not me. So I'm not used to seeing people actually openly express that gratitude. And at that moment, it meant more to me than anything in the world. And I was so proud to be a part of that moment where I was with this person that I loved so much that had just given his life. And when we got into the, Chris didn't want an open casket, but one thing that we asked for is guys that are in our program, they're given a patch that's very specific to our community. And it's almost like a biker gang. We jokingly refer to as getting patched in. And, so it's got its own little thing. You have to pass a certain wickets. You go through a probationary period and then we accept you when you deploy. And then, your first time, but up until then you can kick you out at any point in time because you have to earn your stripes every day or earn your patch every day in this case, right? Well, we wanted to leave our patches with Chris, and right before we did, the Master Chief that was in charge of us, he said, "You know, we shouldn't pity Chris, we should envy him because he died doing what he loved the most." And his mother said the same thing, that Chris, the whole time he was in the Navy, never felt like he belonged until the first day he started with our community. And he told his mom, I found home. This is where I belong. And we loved him, absolutely loved Chris. When Chris, as we know him as a person, left this earth, he had his rifle in his hand, spent rounds all around him, his chief's anchor on his chest, which is means a lot to anybody in the Navy if you're make chief, American flag on his back, and his gear right beside him. And for those of us who do the job, there was no better way to go.
As they say in the Norse stuff, it was a good death.
It was.
As much as that weird sounds, but yes, I know what you're saying.
Yeah. No, it's always in the back of your mind when you do you've been on a lot of operations that there's a way to go, and that there couldn't have been a more honorable one. Now, another thing about being in the Navy is when you make the rank of chief, it's a really big deal. And the legacy of being a chief is something that we pass on to everyone around us. And that same year, 2 months after Chris died, for one reason or another, I ended up having to leave that command and go to another command in Hawaii to go work back in the intelligence community. And it was a very painful transition for me because I thought I was handing everything back to Chris, and Chris never came home. Never came back to the command. And so I felt like I'd failed all of my people. I felt like I was just not turning over the way that I needed to, turning over responsibility. And that year, I was helping run, when you make chief, you go through what's called chief initiation or the season or whatever they refer to it. It changes all the time, but you go through the 6-week process and it's very elaborate. And it's kind of like a mini boot camp for chief selects. And one of the things I coordinated with is I made sure we had 24 chief selects that year. And I gave every one of them a small bag of sand that they had to carry with them everywhere they went. And I said, "Don't ask me what this is for, but here's your responsibility. Your responsibility is to carry this with you everywhere you go." And they were like, "Okay, another stupid initiation thing that you're making us do." So they carried it around. We'd work out with it. Sometimes they drag it on the floor, but I was on their case all the time about the fact that they needed to carry that weight. And that halfway through their season, I stood them, they all had to stand and we were giving training. And I told them the story that I just told you all about Chris. And I said, when Chris Pike set foot on his helo right before that last op, they had to weigh everyone because they have to make sure that you work with time and manifest, that you won't overload the helicopter. He weighed, with his body armor, his kit, and everything on him, he weighed 317 pounds.
Holy cow.
Yeah, most of our gear is about 100 pounds when we're operating.
No kidding. And
so he weighed 317 pounds. And I asked the chief selects, I said, if you add together all the weight that you're holding in your rucks right now, how, what does it come out to? And they did the math and they realized, wait, are we carrying 317 pounds? And I said, you know, this entire time, you have seen what you thought is the burden of weight being placed on your shoulders because you've taken on the this role of being a chief select or becoming a chief. And I said, there's one of two things that you can do in this world, in this world. When you are given these particular, this weight, you can see it as one of two things. You can see it as a burden that you have to endure, or you can see it as a responsibility that you can honor. Those anchors that you're going to put on your chest or put on your collar are going to be heavy. But the people before you, they're the ones who carried it as well. And it is your responsibility to honor that. So the only thing that you can do is not ask for lighter weight, but to build broader shoulders, because that's what Chris would have done.
Wow. I'm speechless after that one, because yeah, you take a totally different perspective on it, didn't you? Completely. Yeah. And is that kind of a key thing to help you get through combat situations and stuff like that, is to know that's your burden? And you got to figure out a way to make sure it gets carried properly.
That's the entirety of it. It's never about wanting to shed responsibility. It's about recognizing that you can always do a little more.
Understood. And tell me about the Beanie Baby.
That's right. So the Beanie Baby was, here's the type of person that Chris was. When they would get care packages back from the States, and a care package came in, and for some reason this care package arrived and it had some stuffed animals in it and a Beanie Baby. And Chris was like, that's mine. And everybody's like, what? Why do you want a Beanie Baby? And it's because every time Chris went out, he carried something to give to kids.
Oh, okay.
Always had something. He always needed to, so here's the thing. He had 100 pounds of gear on him already. Why would you add weight? Why would he carry that American flag? Why would he carry that Beanie Baby? And the American flag stayed in Reese Bell's pocket all the way until the moment that he handed it to Chris's mom.
Wow.
At that ceremony.
Exactly.
So, yeah. And the Beanie Baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. That's great. So just in regards to your friend Chris and when he was repatriated back to the States, mm-hmm. I remember seeing a movie where there was a soldier who escorted a repatriated soldier back mm-hmm. to the States for his burial. Is that similar to what you guys do, that there's one person that stays with the casket for the entire transport?
That's what Reese did.
That's what Reese did, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was there all the way until he arrived in Phoenix when we relieved him. And then the rest of us stood that watch with him until Chris was... he was eventually interred at Arlington.
It was, yeah. And they do that in full dress uniform, too, when they do that.
Well, Reese was flying back from combat, so he was in his combat uniform all the way until he got back.
And then
we call them op camis.
Oh, is that what it is now?
So there's the battle dress uniform, but that's not what you wear when you're done. Well, I guess he was wearing kind of a BDU variant, but it was most of the time we were op camis downrange.
Right on. Interesting. Yeah. So you've taken all this experience, Chris, and you've worked it into being an author, and you write books.
I do. Yeah, I actually dedicated the book to Chris that I wrote.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. And are they fictional military-based stories?
They are. So I wrote a techno thriller. I'm not going to lie, though. There is some of those may or may not be events that took place that I kind of hid in fiction.
It's artistic license, man. You can take that.
I originally wrote it with a way of saying, hey, how can I help find another way for my kids to know me when I can't tell them specifically some of the stuff I did? And maybe I could bury it in fiction. Uh-huh. So just between my kids and me, I'll circle points and say, this was real. That was real. That was real.
Nice. You know,
this happened here, not there. So yes, I did hide some of that in there. But and then some of it was some of my friends' experiences, some of the horrible tragedies they went through, some of the major triumphs that they had. It's all kind of in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how many books do you have out right now?
I just have the one, and I have the sequel coming out this year.
Oh, you do, eh? Excellent.
Yeah.
Good stuff. J.L. Hancock, Jim to his friends, thank you so much for that really uplifting story. It's something else. That's I'll carry that one with me for a while, and I'll share that with some folks. I'll tell you that. Having my father a World War II veteran, my grandfather a World War I veteran, I have a special place in my heart for you guys. So
no, I appreciate it.
Excellent. Yeah. So tell the folks how they can find your book and the title of your book, and find out more about and follow along so they don't miss your next one.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so the book is called The Hawk Enigma. You can find it on Amazon or Audible. You can basically anywhere that most books are sold. Mm-hmm. And you can find out more about me at my website, just jlhancock.com.
Outstanding. We'll definitely have, hopefully folks will check that out and pick up that book, knowing that there is some smattering of truth in there, and then they won't know which one it is.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you very much.
I can't thank you enough for spending time with us today.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us for 1001 True Stories with me, Brian Tremblay. If you think you have a harrowing story, scary, strange, frightening, or a life-changing story that happened to you, and you'd like to share it on the program, email me at brian@morinstreetmedia.com. The link is in the show notes. That's brian@morinstreetmedia.com. We enjoy reviews as well as you sharing our show with others, and there will be new stories from more people who have been to the edge and back every Sunday at noon Eastern Time. Until next Sunday, this is 1001 True Stories with Brian Tremblay. Everyone's got a story. What's yours?